Money, Riches, and Wealth is sponsored by the Financial Consulate. Say you don't need no diamond rings, and I'll be satisfied. Tell me that you want the kind of things the money just can't buy. I don't care too much for money. Money can buy me love. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. Time now for Money, Riches, and Wealth. Here's your host, Drew Tignanelli.
This is Drew Tignanelli here, Money, Riches, and Wealth. We have a guest tonight, so we're going to be doing an interview in about a minute or so. But first, I just wanted to give an update from our talk last week. We were talking about the stimulus checks, and people were asking, well, if you don't file a tax return, do I have to? And I was saying yes. But exactly why I was telling you yes, you have to file a tax return, Secretary of Treasury Mnuchin was out saying, no, we've changed our mind and we're going to send the check to every Social Security recipient that doesn't file a tax return as long as it's not SSI, Supplemental Security Income. So for the most part, they're saying that they're going to cover all the Social Security recipients that don't file tax returns. Personally, I would still recommend that if you don't file a tax return, that you figure out if you can to just do it. That way you cover all your bases. In case for something goes wrong with the Social Security analysis, you've got the tax return in there to get the check also. So I just wanted to tell you that because there were a few people that asked that last week, and I didn't want to leave that alone. But tonight we have a guest, Branko Milanković, or Milanković. I'll have to ask him how he wants to pronounce that. It's his name, so I'll let him pronounce it. His book, Capitalism Alone, The Future of the System That Rules the World. And we're going to hear what Branko thinks about that, and we'll have a good conversation. So, Branko, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
How do you say your last name?
Well, Milanović.
Milanović. That's what I assumed, even though it's just a C there. Or some Americans would just call it Milanović, but it's Milanović. All right. So thank you. So tell me, answer this question for me. Sum your book up in just a couple sentences. Your title is Capitalism Alone. Are you saying that capitalism is it? It's the best? Or are you saying capitalism needs improvement? Or are you saying there are other economic systems like socialism or communism that are better? Sum it up.
Well, the title is really basically an empirical title. The title of Capitalism Alone simply means that capitalism is the only system in the world now, including in China and Vietnam, so that's the only way that the production is organized. It's not a judgment call. Actually, you can say it's a judgment to the extent that capitalism has triumphed or defeated other systems, including socialism or feudalism or whatever you want to call something else. But it's really a factual statement. So I really don't want to go too much, and you didn't want to go in the book, into the value judgments, whether it is really the best and what are the, you know, whether they are the alternatives. I actually wanted to first go empirically that it is with us. Secondly, I would look at different types of capitalism. And thirdly, I would look at good and bad sides of capitalism.
Okay. So that's a good summation. That's the way I was sort of taking the book. And, you know, one thing I'll give you is that you get the world record of having to have a dictionary to figure out some of the words that you used in this book. My wife is a bit of a wordsmith, and I turned to her and I'd say, have you ever heard of this word? And she'd look at it and she goes, nah, I've never heard it. We had to get dictionaries out to look up some of these things. So I'll give you credit for that. That's you get a reward. You get a badge for most.
Well, I'm not sure it's always a credit, because actually maybe some people would be put off, you know, from reading the book if they think it's really hard. But I honestly think it was not. I did actually get a similar comment from a friend of mine, but these are really some words from time to time, so don't scare people off. Actually, 99.9% of the words are really simple.
Now, where was your original country of origin?
Actually, I'm from Serbia.
Serbia, okay. Great country. I've been in there, and it's beautiful, absolutely beautiful.
But they don't speak English.
Well, fortunately, I had somebody there that did speak Serbian and English all at the same time, so that helped a lot. So the thing you talk about in the book, you're talking about global inequality is a big issue that you talk about in the book.
Right.
So give me a little bit, you know, because people are hearing this all the time. Global inequality, inequality's rising. It's a big problem. Inequality's rising. So give us your take on this.
Yeah, this is a little bit tricky because, of course, inequality is rising. Let's look at the United States. It is a big issue because it is higher now than it was like 30 years ago. It's probably a reason over the last 2 or 3 years or so we don't have the data yet, because it really, for inequality, you need at least a couple of years until the data come in. But when you speak of global inequality, that's an entirely different animal. We are there talking about inequality in the entire world, which means every citizen of the world, like, you know, 7.5 billion people. But there the story is different because of Chinese and Indian and Vietnamese and so on growth. You actually had a decline in global inequality. In other words, the Chinese and Indians have now become much more similar in their incomes to the Americans than they used to be 30 years ago. So that's kind of a little bit tricky to actually keep in mind. At the same time, inequality within countries like the U.S. can be up, and inequality in the world as a whole can be down.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting that there are, what, 7 billion people on the Earth, but I would guess that there's probably barely 2 billion that are really participating in the economic prosperity of the world.
Well, of course, it depends really what is the definition of economic prosperity. Certainly, if you take, for example, the American standard of the middle class, you don't have that many people in the world who are at that level and above. Actually, even the very poorest Americans are at what is called about 75th percentile of the world, which means that about 75% of the people in the world are poorer than them, and 25%, are better off. So that gives you an idea that applying an American standard, because the U.S. is a rich country, so even relatively poor people are rather rich in the global sort of frame of things, that gives you an idea how actually sort of a modest income or even sort of lower income American family could fare in the world. So they would not be bad off worldwide.
So hold on with me, Branko. We have to take our first break with traffic sure. and so forth, and we're going to come back, get more into the details of capitalism alone and what's going on in the world. What's the future of the system that rules the world? Right now, I got to go to traffic. Take it away, traffic. This is Drew Tignanelli, host of Money, Riches, and Wealth, and president of the Financial Consulate. Are you looking for a professional financial advisor that you can trust and help you through all stages of life? Having a team of comprehensive personal financial advisors and CPAs gives us the ability to help you prepare your tax return, strategize to help you minimize tax liability, help you visualize and reach your retirement goals, and help guide you in every other facet of personal financial planning. We demonstrate these abilities every Wednesday night on our radio show, Money, Riches, and Wealth. Have you been wanting a second opinion? Then consider our trademark service, the Financial Physical. We guarantee if you don't come away from your Financial Physical with a sense of immense value, then there will be absolutely no charge. Call 410-823-7283 to speak with me and the team of comprehensive personal financial advisors and CPAs. That is 410-823-SAVE, or go online to financialphysical.com. That's financialphysical.com.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBS.
All right, we're back. Money, Riches, and Wealth. We're here with Branko Milanković, and we're talking about capitalism alone. Capitalism is basically the economic system that the world is pretty much adopted. And, it's, you know, like Branko says, he doesn't necessarily say it's good or bad. It may need tweaking, et cetera, but it's the one that's come. And so, you know, one interesting point you brought up here, Branko, that I didn't, and I work with very wealthy people quite often. I never put it into numbers. But you said that the average person makes about 70 to 90% of their income through labor, or 70 to 100% of their income through labor, but the rich make about only 10 to 20% of their income through labor. The majority of their income comes through the capital that they've accumulated over time. I never put the numbers to it, but when you say it, it's fascinating.
Well, yeah, that's true, actually. You know, obviously in the past, this is, we are not talking about what I call liberal or meritocratic capitalism, or you can call modern capitalism. This has really somewhat changed, because in the past, really, if you look, let's suppose you look at England in 1850, then most of the income of the rich would be, actually all of the income of the rich would be simply coming from property, whether it is landed property or capital and so on. Now, still the rich have this proportionate part of their income coming from ownership. But it's a little bit better or a little bit different, because they do also have some labor income, and actually even some people who have labor income can be among the top. Nevertheless, it is true that actually the very richest people, top 1%, even top 5%, have lots of their income from property.
So you just said something at the very beginning, liberal meritocratic democracy, I mean capitalism, and you defined three different types of capitalism. Right. Is that correct?
Yes, actually I've got several definitions, but you know, basically we can go with, you know, three of them, yes.
Go ahead. So tell them.
Yes. So one, actually, what they called it now, like liberal meritocratic, is basically, just to make it sort of simple, it's basically U.S. capitalism, which is very, not that different, despite what people, of course, argue, but that's not different from the West European capitalism. So then the second type, which would be the capitalism of the, probably in the U.S. from FDR all the way to 1980s, would be more social democratic capitalism, which of course nowadays also exists in Nordic countries in Europe. So it is capitalism where the state plays a more important role, taxation is higher, state provided education and health is more important than in a liberal capitalism. And the third type, it is actually really for China and countries like China, what they call political capitalism, which is yet different, because it is not a capitalism with democracy, it's a capitalism with authoritarian system, but where the state really plays an active role even in the economic space, you know, decisions on interest rates, decisions of allocation of credit and things like that.
So despite the fact that the United States is much more of a, you know, I guess a meritocratic capitalist system, that, you know, you have some social, you know, programs and so forth, but nothing like Europe, yet Europe's Europe's inequality, income inequality, is just as high as the United States, according to your book.
Well, no, it's not as high, actually. Most of the countries have lower. U.S. is somewhat of a sort of outlier within the group of rich countries, because it has higher inequality.
But it didn't seem like, according to your charts, it didn't seem like it was that much of a difference.
No, you know, it is a difference when you focus on those countries. And then, of course, when you look at the U.S. versus, I suppose, Germany, you notice significant difference. When you put the U.S. in the global framework, as I was saying before, the, you know, European countries, continental European countries, and the U.S. are not that different, because then you, of course, zoom or highlight the difference of China, the difference of South Africa, Brazil, and elsewhere. So it's really basically, it's like your point of view. If your point of view is really only, let's look at the rich countries, U.S. has higher inequality than actually almost all. If you look at the world, is the U.S. like an outlier? No, because you have countries like Brazil, Colombia, Chile, with much higher inequality.
So what do you attribute the inequality to in the United States? What's your opinion?
Well, you know, it's of course a difficult topic, has been debated for many years, but I would actually try to sort of divide the economists in basically three groups. They are the economists who actually highlight recent policy changes. And when I say recent, we are not really dealing here in a book. I'm not dealing in a book with like what happened last year or a year before. I'm really dealing with what happened over the last 30 years. and that's the decline of the top marginal tax rates, really increased feelings for inheritance taxation and lower taxes on capital. So that actually, many economists highlight that. They say there is also on top of that deregulation, weakening trade unions. So that's the explanation. The other two groups are actually a little bit different. There is a group that actually says, okay, this really happened because technological change was such that jobs of people who are in the middle were replaced by, you know, automation, robotics, whatever. So they lost out and inequality went up. And the third group says, well, that's really because of globalization, because we had so many jobs exported to China that people in the middle lost their jobs and inequality went up because of globalization. So these are really, I would say, three different views. I would say that my view is the closest to the last one, where I think globalization really played a very important role.
What about education?
Well, you know, education, of course, comes in. It is actually, you can obviously, you can say that education contributed to the extent that actually it became much more expensive, less affordable for many, you know, families. And by being less affordable, that meant that actually their children could not aspire to as good education maybe as they themselves had, and that in the future, the income, the wages of these, you know, children, which now are adults, have suffered from that. So the education comes, I would say, under the policy side.
See, now I would disagree with that, because personally, I think the public education system of the country is about as horrible an education system as there could possibly be anywhere in the world. And I also think, you know, when you look at all the money that's been given to people to go to college if they want to, in the sense of loans, and you look at just what my family did back in 1980 and what many of other clients and so forth did back in the 1980s, just going to public state universities and then going on to do something different, I would have to disagree.
What is your point? Do you think it was good or it's bad? I didn't understand. Would public universities, you said they were not good?
No, I said they were fine. They did what they needed
That's
to
what
do
I thought,
to
get actually, yeah, yeah.
That they did what they. But the public high school system was horrible. I mean, just horrible. It almost discouraged me from wanting to go through education. It was so pitiful, and it's worse today.
Yeah, I would actually probably agree. I'm really. Did not focus, and I don't know much about higher education. I was really talking mostly about university education. But, you know, it is nevertheless, there are two things, I think, which happened like over again 40 years, is that in the past, the U.S. had really first-rate public system, and the private system was sort of an extra. But nowadays, with extremely high cost of education for the private, first it has become unaffordable, but that cost also means that if you go through that system, somehow you get in, you actually have parents who are rich to actually fund you through the system, you would also at the end have very high wages. So it actually acts as a kind of a monopoly filter, because it's only if you're really, really rich that you can go through that. So I think this was, in my opinion, this was the sort of an, how should I say, negative change or negative role of the private education system. I'm talking about university level, college level and higher.
See, now we're running out of time for this segment of the show, but when we come back, what I'd like to talk about is, you know, you talk about the self-perpetuating upper class and so forth and so forth, but, you know, my experience has been that the rich do not necessarily produce the rich. Matter of fact, I find that some of my richest clients have offspring that are unlikely to be rich, and history has proven that throughout a long period of time. So we want to talk.
Let's talk about that. Do you want now, or should we talk about that after?
We only have about 45 seconds, so why don't you give me a 40 second blow before we go to the break and then come back? Okay.
I agree. Well, for example, you look at actually there are studies of the, you know, top 400 richest people in the U.S. Because of the technological revolution that we had in the last 20 years, many of them are actually not, they are new people, you know, they have not been there on that list, and their parents certainly have not been there. So there was a big change, there is no doubt about that. But I think what is the danger is that these same rich now will be able through the political process to ensure that their own kids stay at that very high position. So that's about the future.
Well, we'll talk about that when we come back. But right now, I've got to take that next traffic break, and then we're going to talk about capitalism and the goods and bads of it. What's happening? Where is the future of it going? But right now, we're going to traffic. We'll be right back. Money, Rich, and Wealth.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
All right, we're back. Money, Riches, Wealth. We're with Branko Milanković and his book, Capitalism Alone, The Future of the System That Rules the World. And we were talking about before the break that the rich, self-perpetuating upper class, that the rich just keep pouring into their children and they keep the money and all the children just become rich and stay rich and the rich become richer and so forth and so forth. You know, I disagree. I don't see. I mean, there is no doubt there are many families who have done really good planning and will perpetuate their wealth. But I also see that a lot of those children are not happy with the life they have and so forth. You know, and the thing you talked about, the one thing that I absolutely despise is the estate tax. And you talked about it sort of in a glowing way.
Yes, actually, I think that actually it is a good tax. You may not like it, but let me explain why I think it is a good tax.
That's fine.
If you compare that with wealth tax would be a tax which is assessed every year. So it basically you pay every year some percentage, and it's actually above a certain limit. The inheritance tax is one-off. So it's basically when a person dies and when people, his or her sons, kids, or wife, or whoever, has to inherit that wealth. First of all, it's not like a tax that would be paid by probably 95% of the people because it really depends how high you put the exemption. So the objective is not really to actually get money from anybody for people who have left very little or moderate amounts of money. But for the people who actually have huge amounts of money or significant amounts of money, you really want to equalize opportunities that their children have with children who are also well off, but maybe a little bit less well off, because I'm not really talking of driving these kids into poverty, obviously. But and really, if you look at this, these kids have not, offsprings have not really contributed anything to this. So it is really, you're giving them something from the point of view of equality of opportunity, which they really don't deserve.
Well, you say that, but that's your opinion. But does government deserve it?
No, the government doesn't deserve it, but you can, of course, use that money to actually give grants for people who are, I suppose, who are at 21 years of age. You give them a grant of, could be $10,000, could be $15,000, could be $20,000. So you would actually further equalize the opportunities, and you would make the sort of the starting positions much more similar than if you have one child with one kid with like $2 million, another kid with zero.
So you're talking about a whole different thing, because that's not the way the estate inheritance tax works. Any estate inheritance tax, which is a very little amount of money that actually ends up in the hands of government at the end, government tends to use very inefficiently throughout their use of the money. But, you know, the problem I have, Branko, is that, you know, the whole concept of having to go through the process of working with clients who are dealing with a difficult subject anyway, the subject of estate planning and dying, and to develop, you know, the strategies necessary to work with and to, you know, because we're going to do that. That's what we do as CPAs and financial advisors. We love this stuff, you know, is trying to figure out how do we circumvent your estate tax. But then after the person dies, I now have to deal with a grieving family and try to explain to them things we got to do and so forth. It's just a horrible, horrible tax.
I can imagine that. I mean, actually, because of the virus, I actually went through this stuff for myself, you know, recently. So it's not obviously a pleasant thing for anybody because we essentially have to deal with death and distribution of money after death. So it's really unpleasant by definition. Nobody likes that. What I'm saying, and I think actually I don't want to repeat what I said before, but I think leaving that aside, which that unpleasantness is kind of unavoidable, I think that particular tax would make equality between equality of opportunity, not the equality of outcome, but the equality of opportunity between different people, different individuals at a relatively young age, or maybe, you know, at the age of 30 or so on, more equal opportunities would be distributed more equally. So that's the idea. So basically,
let me ask you this question. Did you realize that when the estate tax was originally established, there were only 75 families in America that could potentially have paid the estate tax? In 1980, when I first got in this business, one of my first clients was a widow who had a total estate of $700,000 in 1980, and she was going to have to pay $150,000 in estate tax because her husband didn't do any estate planning until Ronald Reagan came into office in 1982 and eliminated the estate tax from husband and wife. That's the evil that I see in these taxes. I agree with your general concept you're talking about. Unfortunately, politicians get in the way.
I mean, if that tax were actually just shifted to the overall group of taxes, then you might have a case. But I think actually that tax should be specifically used to help people who are actually starting their life or who basically have no money, whether it is for school, to open a small business and so on. So it would be actually earmarked tax. You can call it equality opportunity tax because it would really shift money from one group to another. Now, obviously for people like yourself and others, I think that the existence of many different ways to circumvent, as you were saying, taxation, of course, gives good jobs to some people, but on the other hand, it's very demoralizing also because people spend lots of money, lots of time to do that. If you had a fairly simple tax and not an exorbitant tax, I think we would be all better off.
I agree with you that the income tax system is terribly flawed. It has been flawed ever since I've been in the business. It should be a very straightforward tax at a very reasonable rate that nobody really can circumvent. If you're Warren Buffett and you make and you have $1 billion, you're going to pay $20, $40, $50, $100 million in income tax. I don't care. But, you know, the law is so stupid, and the way they put it together is a hodgepodge of ridiculous political garbage.
But I think I'm paying, you know, U.S. income tax. So I've, the reason I think why it is so complicated is because it was created over a long period of time with different people, different constituencies, different groups, adding their small thing here and there. So at the end, it becomes an animal that is really very difficult to figure out. And then you have really to spend lots of time or pay people who basically are going to find the best possible ways to trick the system, to sort of circumvent it, to actually game the system, rather. And
I think almost everybody
you speak would be in favor of simple tax, moderate tax, and tax that you cannot avoid paying.
Yeah, you know, I hear what you're saying. I do about 800 tax returns a year, and we're always looking for what are the legal ways to minimize that tax. It's not gaming the system. It's dealing with the tax law as it's written. But as smart as I am about the tax laws, I got to admit that no matter how many times I look at a tax return, I'm overlooking things because it's just that complicated nowadays. It's ridiculous.
When I said gaming, I didn't mean it in a negative sense. It's just the sort of finding the best possible way to do certain things while this is legal. So that's basically.
So you should have said the brilliant CPAs of America out there working for the best of their client. That's what you meant, right?
Well, that's true. They're working for the best of their client given the system as it is.
All right, Bonica, when we come back, you're going to tell us what the future of the system is because we're going into our last quarter and what you think ought to be the future of the system, how we should modify it, et cetera, and go from there. All right, we're going to go now to traffic. We'll be right back. Money, Riches, and Wealth. This is Drew Tignanelli, host of Money, Riches, and Wealth, and president of the Financial Consulate. Are you looking for a professional financial advisor that you can trust and help you through all stages of life? Having a team of comprehensive personal financial advisors and CPAs gives us the ability to help you prepare your tax return, strategize to help you minimize tax liability, help you visualize and reach your retirement goals, and help guide you in every other facet of personal financial planning. We demonstrate these abilities every Wednesday night on our radio show, Money, Riches, and Wealth. Have you been wanting a second opinion? Then consider our trademark service, the Financial Physical. We guarantee if you don't come away from your financial physical with a sense of immense value, then there will be absolutely no charge. Call 410-823-7283 to speak with me and the team of comprehensive personal financial advisors and CPAs. That is 410-823-SAVE or go online to financialphysical.com. That's financialphysical.com.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBL.
We're back. Money, Riches, and Wealth. We're here with Branko Milanović about capitalism, capitalism alone, and the future of the system that rules the world. And we're talking about the future now. Where's it headed? So Branko, let me ask you this. You go back to the early part of the 1900s, and you look at some of the greatest capitalists of the country, Milton Hershey or Gillette or Asa Candler of Coca-Cola or how can I forget his name? The guy from Standard Oil and so forth. And you look at all these
Rockefeller,
thank you. Yeah. And you look at all these billionaires that are signing pledges to give away all their money upon their death, like Warren Buffett and so forth. And you look at Bill Gates and you look at the great corporations of America that are going into social engineering and saying a portion of our money is going to go toward this or go toward that, et cetera, et cetera. Is there anything wrong with the way the system's working?
Okay, is it wrong that they should be giving some money? No, I don't think it's wrong. It's actually good that they're giving some money. But I think that actually if you have a choice, let me put this in front of you. One choice is that you have fair, high taxation for people who are very rich, as you were saying before, which they cannot avoid by doing anything, basically by creating trust, not by doing some shenanigans or whatever.
And we don't do shenanigans, Branko. I told you that earlier. So go ahead.
Okay. Whatever, they can do nothing, so they have to pay it. So that's one possibility. The other possibility, they sort of find a legal way to circumvent taxation, and they don't pay, but then they say, okay, really, I would like to pay, maybe I would fund the Philharmonic Orchestra, maybe I would do this, maybe I would do the theater, maybe I would do actually even things which are quite extraordinary and very important, like fighting the disease. Now, I think between these two, it seems to me that the first solution is better because it does not depend on the preference and the whims of individuals.
So let me ask you quickly, real quickly, is whose fault is that? Is it the capitalist or is it the idiots that run the country?
Well, no, you're very strong, so I would not use that second sort of phrase that you're using about who is running the country. But I think that's, again, going back to the sort of taxation system. And obviously, the book is not about taxation system. It actually spends very little time on that. But since we are talking about this, I have to, sort of focus on this. It is actually having a reasonable and fair taxation system for everybody. And I think in that case...
But who develops the taxation system of the country?
Well, the politicians, of course, and actually to a large extent, politicians who are very often funded by the people who want the system to run in their favor.
Right. I don't disagree with that, but whose fault is that?
Well, I'm not putting a blame, but I'm just saying that when you ask me the question about whether it is actually good that people pledge the amounts of money, very rich people, I think, yes, it is good because the alternative would be they don't pledge anything, so which, in my opinion, would be much worse. I mean, we have to say that, for example, now with Gates, he's paying, $175 million or whatever was the amount to actually try to speed the development of the vaccine. Yes, is it good? Definitely. But I think it would be better if that money was already taken from him before and the vaccine that money was used 2 years ago to develop a vaccine.
But so you see you make the assumption that government is going to be efficient and use the money that they take from people to do good things. That's the assumption you're making.
Well, I'm not saying that government is going to be efficient, and of course that's the book about capitalism where government does play a fairly limited role. The government is not going to be efficient in producing iPhones or producing shoes or producing, detergent powder or whatever, and cars. But the government's role is to actually be efficient in things which are sort of public importance, like, as we see, health right now, or education, or infrastructure, all of that. For example, you know, I live in New York. In New York, I'm not talking about what is happening now, but even if you look at infrastructure, is really sort of crumbling for a city of the importance of New York. And that's actually, nobody's going to do privately. I'm not going to pave the road, you know.
No, but, you know, they got plenty of money in over the years to do that. And why did they not do it?
Yeah, that, I don't know, but I'm just saying that really definitely the infrastructure investment in the U.S. is sort of has plummeted, and that's something which really the government does. So, but let me just not give the impression to the listeners that the book is about taxation. It is really, when you speak of future of capitalism, it's a book also on whether a more political capitalism like Chinese would become more interesting or acceptable to some countries or not. And I think that's a very important part.
Well, after looking what Chinese political capitalism did over the last 3 or 4 months, I don't think it's going to be very attractive to anyone right now.
That's true, actually. I think this was a big sort of a negative for them, because they've been trying very hard over the last 20 years to actually have this sort of a soft power and sometimes money power, combined the two, soft power and money. But what has happened now with basically the entire world suffering, first in terms of casualties and secondly in terms of the economy, it's a huge shock, I think.
So let me ask you this question. And you said to make this statement in the book, and I was kind of confused by it. You kind of said that Hong Kong and Singapore were very successful capitalists, but they're kind of one-off because they're very small countries and they can do that, and it couldn't happen on a big scale like in the United States. That's the way I read it. Did I read it right?
Not entirely, because I actually use Singapore as an example of also political capitalist country, because Singapore has had one party in government since its independence. So it's actually, I think, 1961. So it has been now 60 years, and you have like one or two people from the opposition in parliament, and that's all. So basically, it has been run as a single party state, but it's an extremely technocratic state. And in some sense, it's being run extremely well.
Yeah. And Hong Kong, too, until, you know, they're getting interfered with now. But Hong Kong's been very successful. Both countries
have
a lot.
There is no doubt.
Yeah. And both countries have relatively low taxation, relatively free markets, et cetera, et cetera. To me, that's where the future ought to be looking.
Well, I would, you know, agree. Actually, that's what I'm saying. That's why the political capitalism, which is run very efficiently by the government.
How do you do that,
Singapore,
though? How do you do that?
I don't know. You know, when you said before, when you said, is Singapore's example sort of transferable elsewhere? It is true that the size does matter. You know, it is true that Singapore is, after all, a city state. It had extremely highly educated people, very smart leaders, hugely technocratic government. Now, whether you can do that in a very diverse country like the United States, or let's take South Africa, or take Brazil, I kind of doubt that. So it's not fully exportable, but I think some features could be exportable.
So, you know, how about your home country, Serbia? Do you think that they have, you know, come a long way doing good things?
Well, they have currently a government that is basically sort of autocratic, in the sense that you have the elections, but only one party can win the elections. They have popularity, but of course they control the media as well, so to make sure that that popularity does not evaporate. And now with the corona crisis, they have become very dependent on China, because China has provided doctors and medication and so on. So basically China is now running the health system in Serbia.
So corruption, that's the big bugaboo. Corruption. How do you weed that out of a political system?
You know, the corruption in a political system, I think, is really something which is pervasive in all countries. If you look at
absolutely,
that, you see it everywhere. It has become really sort of a modus operandi, which is taken essentially for granted. Whatever country you take it, with Russia, U.S., China, Italy, France, you find it everywhere. So I think actually, as I explained in the book, I think in countries like China or political capitalism, you have corruption, which is an integral part of the system because there is no rule of law, and yet you have to have an efficient bureaucracy to manage this, that country. And then between these two, you have the space for corruption, because if you have a good bureaucrat, he should be running according to the book. But there is some points where he cannot do that, and that's where the corruption comes in. So I think it is an integral part of the Chinese system. But on the other hand, I also think that to some level, we have to, I know that may not be very popular, but we have to accept some level of corruption, because otherwise, I think we cannot, there are certain types of corruption we should not accept, but some others, we really have to accept them because they're so pervasive and they're so present everywhere that you cannot just go and eradicate it anymore.
I would say amen to that, unfortunately, but I think it's just the way it is with human beings. They're both good and evil all at the same time, and they're going to do things like that, you know? And if you can just limit the corruption, that's about the best you can do. Well, we're out of time, Bronco. I loved your book. I loved talking to you. I think I could have kept doing this for another hour or two. I don't know that you'd want to talk to me for another hour or two, but I enjoyed
very much
being with you.
I enjoyed it very much. I really appreciate actually being able to speak at your program, and it was really a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Bronco. You take care. And this is Drew Tignanelli saying God bless.